Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner, and you're listening to your source for cool jazz and more, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. And that's Who Knows Where the Time Goes, by Fairport Convention. Richard Thompson of Fairport Convention was born on this day in 1949. I'm talking with Ayanna Beresford Kroger. She's an author and scientist who focuses on helping people develop new relationships with nature. Her books include The Sweetness of a Simple Life, The Global Forest, Arboretum Borealis, Arboretum America, and The Garden of Life. And her book, The Sweetness of a Simple Life, is now about to come out on paperback. It's a great book. They're both great books. I mean, brilliant.
Well, thank you. Thank you.
You've expanded my vocabulary immensely. I appreciate it.
Well, you know, that's E.O. Wilson's fault. Because, you know, he says that we have to, we have to have a new vocabulary for the future, really. And that's his biodiversity thinking. And also, I have extended the vocabulary, too. I've taken that jump. In that we have to extend our description of the natural world because we have kept it to a very unified form in the form of commodities, and we have to think a little differently now.
It's true, and I think in some ways what you've been writing is mm-hmm. is that. I mean, because yeah. you're exploring worlds in ways that people haven't explored them yet. You know, just in terms of your unique ability to weave the scientific and the spiritual.
Yes, and I think, you know, I'm Irish, of course, you can figure that out, and I'm an Irish speaker as well.
I can hear it.
And I can't pretend I'm not here. But, you know, I've been educated really all over the place, and so that kind of soothes off my accent a little bit. But in the old Irish world, it is important to have the body, but you have the mind and the spirit. And you have to look after your mind, and you have to look after the spiritual things of your body. And we do not pay attention to those things, and we do not pay attention to them at our peril, because it is the spiritual greetings of other people that make life so sweet for all of us.
But so many people see them as totally separate worlds, just like we see the worlds of Europe, Africa, and native people, or the worlds of the trees and the forests and the worlds of our science understanding as being very separate.
Yes, but you know, the funny thing, Mark, is that the genome of the tree is far more complex than our genome, and it is based on the same four bases. And two of the bases are a little different, uracil and adenine are a little different, but the actual construction of the genome is exactly the same, with telomeres and the whole darn thing. And the complexity of the tree's genome is far more complex than ours and makes the same ratio of compounds that the human body does.
So what does that say to us, that knowledge? What is it, what is that specific piece of knowledge? What should we be wrestling with that understanding?
It's like the whales. It's like us now looking at the whales, looking at them and looking at us, looking at a tree and looking at us. It is the sweet point, in a sense, of our understanding of the natural world right now, because we do know now that they have that genome. We do know now that they produce serotonin, all of the compounds that are so important for the functioning of our brain. And I do believe that the brain in the tree is the cambium layer. It is the layer all over the surface of the inside the bark of the tree. And I think it behoves us to respect life, all of life around us, because we're built on the same pattern. And if we're built on the same pattern, then there is something greater than us out there. And I don't care what religion you have or what your spiritual leanings are, but as a scientist, it is extraordinary. And, you know, I just said to you earlier on about Albert Einstein.
Right.
Einstein was the great humanist, and he, at the end of his life, bowed his head to all of these things, too. And I think the dialogue of our spiritual world, I think, is just beginning.
I think it is, too. That's why I found the both books that I kind of went through deeply, The Global Forest, 40 Ways Trees Can Save Us, and The mm-hmm. Sweetness of a Simple Life, which is coming out in paperback, that you have this because partially, I guess, how you were raised, which we can talk about in a moment.
Yeah.
You have this ability to kind of understand the trees in a deeply visceral spiritual and a spiritual sense, but also because of your training.
Yeah.
To be able to understand scientifically what they mean and how they've always been married. We just never knew they were married.
Yes, yes, yes. And that's really true, except that, of course, when I was a child, I was told that. See,
uh-huh.
Without the science background. I was told that in Gaelic, and my relatives spoke Latin and Greek, and they trained me in an old form of thinking.
And so that old form of thinking, I mean, I think let me go back to that for a moment, because it's true that I read that you were orphaned as a young girl in Ireland, mm-hmm. and that mm-hmm. you were raised by relatives that one thing I read was that you were raised by relatives that only spoke to you in Gaelic, Latin, and Greek, and that they were of the old religion,
mm-hmm.
the old ways of thinking.
Yeah, well, I'm the last child of the O'Donoghue Béire. On one side, and they are the royal family of the south of Ireland. I'm the last child of that family, and we were of the Onquigamuna, the county of Munster. My family were the kings of Munster, and in old Ireland there was the High King, who was called the An Ordhri, and my family were the educators of the Ordhri in the princeling form. And I am the last child. My whole family was wiped out. And I am the last representative of them. And so all of my second cousins, third and fourth, and even up to seventh cousins decided that they would train me in the old ways in a form of wardship. And so I was taken to different places in the valleys of the south of Ireland, and I was taught all of the old methods of druidic thinking in the forms of meditation, alignment of mind, thinking of respect, of love for nature. And now I was taught all of what you would know, I would have known as anfishoigri. And anfishoigri are all the old cures. All of the old medicine of the ancient world was passed to me by voice.
So when that knowledge you grew up with as a little girl, and then you mm-hmm. and you went to the university to study science.
Yeah, yeah.
And I wonder what epiphanies must have come to you in those things you realized that how deeply they were connected.
Well, that's a very interesting question that you're saying now that's kind of sitting in front of me. I was taught, I mean, I took everything, like I soaked everything up. You know, when a child has been traumatized by losing absolutely everyone, you know, your mother, your father, your brother, the whole lot, you then hang on to religion or you hang on to education. In my case, I hung on to education and I literally studied every bloody thing. I did second year engineering mathematics when I was 15. And my uncle, who raised me, really believed that women should be educated. He was an extraordinary man. And I was brought up in a house full of books. And every evening he would sit on one side of the fire, I'd be on the other. We'd talk about physics or religions or Tibetan Buddhism or poetry in Gaelic theatre, literature, Hilaire Belloc, G.K. Chesterton, all of the writers. I would read to him and he would read to me. And that was the basis of I was brought up, really, I was kind of swimming in a house of books. And then the wardship started in the south of Ireland, where I was taken and taught all the different things. And so when I went into university, I kept that very quiet. You know, I wasn't talking much about my background there, but they all knew that I was from this family. I was treated like royalty in some ways because I come from an exceptional family. And then when I started doing biochemistry, oh my God, I thought, oh my God, this is what they were talking about. And everybody, almost all of those people were all in their 80s and 90s. They were all dead then. And then the world opened to me. Then I studied physics. Like, I raged through the subjects. I mean, I literally did physics. I did a diploma in surgery, you know. I did everything I could lay my hands on, I did. I sucked it up, did my PhD in molecular biology. I studied nuclear radiation, the effect of that on the body. Like, you tell me, and I studied it.
Mm-hmm.
And I went through like a mop. And then at the end of it, there's a certain amount of grace. And you realize the world is going in a way that may not be good for a lot of people. And you stand back and then you look at what you have in your head and how can you use it? How can you use this for the betterment of society? And I was asked to join Nobel Prize teams. I was asked to join the Max Planck. I was asked to join a Nobel team in Australia. And I said no, because I think I was told as a child, I was given a sacred warrant on my head. I was asked as a child, and then I was 12, to take the old knowledge of the Gaelic world, and I was told to take this to the new world. And I understood the new world was the Americas, and I was told to take it, and there would be a time when that was needed. And when the time came for it to be needed, I was to speak about it. And I'm speaking now. I'm speaking in my books. I'm speaking, yes.
And all through these books, because you moved to Canada, is mm-hmm. that I found these connections that you made about the trees around you and the life, what we think of as an animate creatures around us, this life around us. You made these connections between what you learned as a child in that world and your science and the native people of Canada and this hemisphere and their knowledge, and they really are close. I mean, they were married.
Yeah. And the funny thing is that a number of years ago, the head of the Hopi people, they know me, and I've never met them, but they started sending me messages. And they were messages to protect me, messages to look after me. And I know they have their prayer ceremonies down there for me. So there is a unification happening around the world between all peoples. And it's not evident in television. It's not evident in a lot of things. But indeed it is happening. And it's a very joyous thing. It's a wonderful thing. For the children, your children and my children, are very aware of that. And it's an enigma to me,
mm-hmm.
but it is really happening.
It is really happening. And I think that's the kind of the power and beauty of the books that you've written, I think, have to do with how you've been able to weave that in and out of your words with each story that you tell in either of these two books that I've read.
Yeah. And, you know, Mark, I had to teach myself to do that because, you know, the papers that I have written are very esoteric papers. I've made all of the artificial blood, which is now used in kidney and tissue and blood and heart transplants, and the artificial, some of the stroma-free hemoglobin bloods that I've made are now used in the delivery of cancer compounds into the body. And in open heart surgery with hemodilution, the running microspheres into the heart to find out where the heart medication is most effective. And those are the areas that I've worked on and I have been so good at. But, you know, that's very esoteric. That's very strongly phrased into mathematics, phrased into biochemistry. But I want everybody to know. So to unteach yourself these things and to go down to the level where you've to take simplicity and run with simplicity in the head. I had to teach myself how to write in a very simple form of simple poetry, of la 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 la
mm-hmm.
la la,
mm-hmm.
know, because that mathematics then hits the brain and then you have a memory.
You know, it made me think of, I don't know why I did this, but as I was reading these books, words kept popping out of my head. And I'll just read you what some of the words I just wrote here, because I think I'd like to talk about them and kind of go to the heart of some of the things you've been writing about and get into some specifics as well in a few minutes. But I just wrote down, from your words, the different parts. We are not clumps of human flesh. All life is sacred. Children are sacred. Molecular working is extraordinary, as is math and music. Mathematics is sacred, leading us to a renaissance. Science and sacred go together.
Yeah, yeah. Yes, they do. Yes, they do.
That's what I glean from your books. If I could water it down.
Yes. And if you know, we're all based on zero, one and zero, the binomial system. You and I are. Everybody is. We're all based on that. If you crunch down DNA, if you crunch down messenger RNA, you crunch down all the molecular systems of our body, my body, your body, in quantum mechanics, you run it down at zero and one. And in zero and one, we have that form of unity. We have that form of echo unity between us. And that is what makes me think you're sacred. All the children are sacred. The people of this planet are sacred. And if we think that way, we will not have wars. We will not destroy one another. We will then hold hands and make all of our lives better. And we have an obligation to the future to do that.
And I think we do. And I think this is one of the paths. And I think we forget how tied in we are. And I think we don't realize there's a gentleman here I interview on the program often. His name is Gerald Weingart. He's a former state senator here from the state of Maryland, where we're broadcasting from. And he was once known as the environmental conscience of the Maryland State Senate.
Yeah.
And one of the things he's been saying to people, he said, we have to stop all the development in the state and let the forest take the country back if we're to survive.
Yes.
And he was saying that maybe that's what you're saying in some ways.
That's what I'm saying.
Right?
Yeah. Yes, right. Yes, right. And let me go a little farther into his saying, and he is absolutely right. Now, what has happened in the whole of the globe, and we're not going to point any fingers at anybody, and I don't intend to do that. That is not what I wish to do. But all over the world, the forests have come down. And for the last 400 million years, the forests have had a direct function on the life of this planet. It has made the foundation of life on this planet. And what the forests do is really quite extraordinary. And we're only just coming to grips with this. Every leaf on every tree is a shrine. And that shrine is something we do not understand. There is nobody in the scientific world, even in Harvard, nobody understands the function of a leaf, one single leaf. Inside in the leaf you have green, and the green is called chlorophyll. And that chlorophyll is capable of plucking the carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere, adding it to water from the atmosphere again, and in the function, in the face of photons from the sun, can make sugar and bubble out oxygen. You and I are breathing today only because of trees. And that reaction is called a thermodynamic reaction. Okay, it's a big word. Forget the big word. We don't even understand it. We don't even understand the quantum function of that reaction. Not one physicist on this planet understands that. And it is the foundation of our life, and it is also called the photosynthetic reaction. And that ties me and you to the trees forever. Because without the trees, our children will not live. And what we've done, I call the trees the green machine of the planet. That's what I call them. They're big ones, small ones, bulky ones, ugly ones, nice ones, beautiful ones. They're all green machines, the whole lot of them. Without them, we would all die. All of the species like you and I who require oxygen to breathe into our lungs. And what we have done over the last 200, 300 years is we've cut a lot of them down. And so there is no longer that molecular green machine to pluck the carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere, which is a toxic thing in the atmosphere. And it was, the Earth was toxic, very toxic once upon a time, millions and millions and millions of years ago. Now we're going up to the 400 parts per million again. And when they talk about warming the atmosphere, what happens is the sun, the rays of the sun, the photons come down into our atmosphere through our cloud system and bounce by way of radiation up into the clouds again and back down, up and down like a tennis ball. And that is called the greenhouse effect. And that's warming the oceans, it's warming the land. But if we plant trees, we will stop that. God, it's simple. It's so simple and it's so cheap. And all of the politicians talk about financialism. Hey, just get a shovel, get the kids out there, plant the blinking trees, and that's the end of that problem.
It's you, and in this one part of your book, you have the sentence that says this, which you said, the green machine runs the tapestry of nature, fired by the sun's fuel and the green of all plants everywhere.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And do you know, Mark, that all over the globe, we are 95% science illiterate. Only 5% of the people on the planet have some understanding of science. So it behoves scientists like me to be able to write about these things so that everybody understands it. It's not my big secret, but it should be yours and your children's and the rest of us. We should understand this. And if you cannot take any science, any math, anywhere, and reduce it down to simplicity, well, then go off and get a job as a, you know, porter or whatever. Go off and build bricks. Or go off and just put up a wall somewhere. Because you're not worthy of your name.
So, I've read that you started this piece called the Archangel, or part of this Archangel Ancient Tree Archive.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yeah.
Which
right.
is tied to this.
Yeah, yeah. And what that is, do you know that we have, all over the world, we have seeds collected in storage for perpetuity, really, in a way, our crop seeds, like barley and wheat and all the different races of all of our foods. Those seeds have been put away. But nobody has put away anything for the trees. Nothing. Nothing, nothing, nothing. And the only way to do that is to do somatic cloning. I mean, you can save seeds too, but the only sure way is to clone the forests and to clone them. Now, cloning them is maybe a bad word to a lot of people, but that really isn't. So if you, I would clone you. Let's pretend now I'm going to clone you.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to look at your hands, and you're covered with skin all over your body, okay? I just take a little piece of skin. It's the same as skin grafting. That's all it is. You just take the DNA from that piece of skin, and that has the same identity as all parts of you. We're actually unique mirrors of majesty, every single one of us. Every one of us is very, very different. So it's just a piece of skin or a piece of hair, not hair, but a piece of tissue,
mm-hmm.
and then you clone that, and then that becomes you. So we're doing it for the trees. You take clone tissue, and it is ordinary somatic tissue. You take a little bit of something, a little bit of a leaf, and then put it into a petri dish, grow it up, and that will turn out to be a tree. And that's stem cell research. That's exactly the same thing as a woman carrying a child in utero, and the umbilical cord, supplies food into the child, but it's the blood in the umbilical cord which is such a precious thing for the child and for the mom, because that carries the stem cells. And you can repair and fix up the child, fix up you, fix up me. We can. They're even looking at teeth, doing stem cells on teeth. And so, like, if you lose a tooth or lose your front tooth, or in the future, you'll be able to pop in a tooth.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Good dentistry here.
I like that.
You just brought an image into my head of a tree grinning with a whole set of teeth in it. We've got people listening to us and they think, oh, my gosh, she's crazy. Well, have a laugh at it anyway.
Well, if as you write,
yes.
trees have sex,
yes.
as you said, in the global forest, then they yes. probably can grin as well.
Yes, they do. And you know, the very funny thing about the sexuality of a tree. I mean, it really is a scream. Trees are very, very unctuous in their ability to be sexual. They are homosexual, heterosexual, polygamous. they are parthenogenic. In other words, they're even, Virgin Marys, if you want to put it that way, where they can produce a child from nothing. And they have all kinds of sexual variations that you could even ever dream of in the gynecium. It's the smartest thing on earth. And here we are talking about, homosexuals and heterosexuals and transvestites and looking at them, some of us looking, I will not include myself on this, with this kind of a sneer look at these people. That's biodiversity, for heaven's sake. It's the biodiversity of sexuality. And some of these aspects of our sexuality are as important as the homosexual part, as the heterosexual part. Many, many of our geniuses in the world in the past and in the present and coming into the future have been homosexual. I don't know the answer to this from a biochemical point of view, and nobody really does. But it is, they are the people that stream us ahead with their dreams and their wonderful geniuses. And nobody looks at them and says, well, it's biodiversity of sexuality. That's a new thought. But it's been there forever. And some poor people get condemned for this.
Right.
Well, I'm sorry, it's just like condemning somebody with green eyes or because you've got brown eyes. It's nuts. It's absolutely nuts. It belies our basic understanding of who we are.
I'm talking with Ayanna Beresford Kroger. She's an author and scientist who focuses on helping people develop new relationships with nature. Her books include The Sweetness of a Simple Life, The Global Forest, Arboretum Borealis, Arboretum America, and The Garden of Life. And her book, The Sweetness of a Simple Life, is now about to come out on paperback. And you're listening to this conversation right here on your source for cool jazz and more, WEAA 88.9 FM, The Voice of the Community. On our way to break, we're hearing Just My Imagination by The Temptations. It hit number one on this day in 1971. Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner, right here on your source for cool jazz and more, WEAA 88.9 FM, The Voice of the Community. And that Smoke Gets in Your Eyes by Sarah Vaughan, who passed away on this day in 1990. And today I'm talking with Ayanna Beresford Kroger. She's an author and a scientist who focuses on helping people develop new relationships with nature. Her books include Sweetness of a Simple Life, The Global Forest, Arboretum Borealis, Arboretum America, and A Garden for Life. And her wonderful book, which is like a tome for every day a mantra, The Sweetness of a Simple Life, is now out on paperback on April the 7th. I was thinking about this, the chapter in the book, The Global Forest, 40 Ways Trees Can Save Us, that trees define the new sexual revolution. And then in the other book, you have the sweetness of a simple life. There's another piece in there where you actually talk about this woman that you met, who was going through a very frustrating period in her life sexually, and you talked about this menopausal moment, the marriage menopause. And I was thinking of the connection between those two chapters.
Yes, and we all go through this. I mean, all of us go through a form of marriage menopause. And what it is there's a flood of hormones in your system. And when you're going through a menopausal situation, that flood changes. A male and a female has a similar variation of male hormones or female hormones, but they start to reduce in number, the balance starts to change. So the person that you're living with, you're no longer wonderfully, fantastically, unbelievably attracted to them because the ratio is changing. And then you get all upset with yourself, you know, what's happening with me? I no longer want to... Can I say bed this person? Can I say that?
You can say that, yes, you can say
the radio.
You can say bed the person, yes.
and you know what I mean.
Yes.
I mean, it's the men get it and the women get it. I mean, it is there because you're biochemically changing. And then your flood starts to change into another direction. And then you get for some people, you get this wonderful feeling of contentment and you look around the world again and it is different. And then you leave space for your children coming and your children developing. But you are no longer the sexual person you were in your 20s, 30s, and into your 40s. And nobody talks about this. Nobody tells women and men. They allow them to go through this terrible suffering and think that their marriages are at an end. They're not. It's just the change in your own body, and it will readjust itself. And there are actually all kinds of things you can do to help that adjustment. Very, very simple things. Like, for instance, if you are menopausal, I'm talking men and women.
Exactly.
Men do not escape this either.
Right.
So men have trouble sleeping, and all you have to do is go to the fridge at 10 o'clock at night, get a little piece of hard cheese, and eat it for just the size of your fingernail. Eat it, because what that does is it puts calcium into your stomach. The calcium is a divalent cation. It picks up your insulin. It makes your insulin work for 6 hours. It really beats the hell out of your insulin, making you work and making you sleep. You know, like, there are... Now, how cheap is that? I mean, how cheap is that? And also, you know, like, lie in bed and meditate a little. Think about the good things in your world. Thank the nice things that have happened to you in your world. And then you will fall asleep. But what that does is it affects the parasympathetic nervous system. It just calms it all down and it paces down your heart. And you can sleep. I mean, how simple is that?
I mean, when you...
They'll throw us off the air here.
Really? I'll try the cheese tonight, but when you describe this, part of the what the wisdom that comes out of these books is that the wisdom of the ages before Western, Asian, or African science began to explain things to us in a scientific manner, they've been there forever. This is, you know, they may not have known the formulas or the Latin terms, but this knowledge has always been with us.
It's a basic inherent wisdom, and it's just the same as taking everybody listening to us today, I will ask you to go out and walk for 20 minutes. A 20-minute walk actually exercises your pancreas. And if you oxygenate your brain, oxygenate your full body in the circulation, in your full circulation, your heart is racing a little bit, you take a 20-minute walk, you will be healthier. It will really improve your basic health for the whole of your body, because it oxygenates your body. I mean, that's very simple. And that means that you will not get all the diabetes. It means that you are actually working your insulin, working your glucagon, working your islets of Langerhans, working them all, and you're not going, you know, your heart will be okay. You will get thinner. You will get into better shape. And, I mean, 20 minutes out of a life per day is not much.
It's not. Just get up a little earlier and just do it. It really is that simple. Going back to the books and the trees for a moment. Because one of the things about this, what you have discovered in these trees is the healing qualities inside the tree. From the bark in and out and from the different sides of the tree. This is an ancient wisdom that we're losing, is that what these trees can do to heal us and keep us well.
Mm-hmm. And the research for most of that is coming out of Japan, and is also coming out of the cloud chamber studies out of Germany. Now, if you want to cover this in more detail, look at my blog, and it's dianasjourney.com. So that's the blog for the film. So that will give you forest bathing. It will give you the idea of boosting up your health. Now, let's go into this right now a little bit.
Yeah, please.
In the forest, the green machine produces the most complex chemistry and biochemistry and medicines known to man. All of the women out there who are, God help us, who are suffering from breast cancer, and all of the female cancers, get a compound called, out of the family, called taxane. And it's taxopherol. And that taxopherol has what's known as 11 chiral centers. And chiral centers are like little antennae. And the antennae help the molecule to mobilize in the cell into the more important parts of the cell to stop cancer. That comes from a tree. That comes from a tree. And no organic chemist can manufacture that. It is such a complex chemical with those 11 chiral centers on it. There's your anti-cancer compound. Many, many, many species of trees produce anti-cancer compounds. Now, for the listening public, what I will ask you to do is, when the summer comes around, because the United States of America has got wonderful, wonderful pine trees, go and find yourself some pine trees, all right? I would say maybe even bring a glass of wine with you, like maybe you know, just a little drop of wine with you. Go and into a pine forest when the temperature is 85 degrees approximately. That is when the maximum release of pinene, alpha, beta, and gamma pinene, is released into the air. And when you're walking in the forest, go slowly. Stroll in the forest. Pick up leaves. Pick up sticks, because there are endogenous fungi in those sticks, and those actually stop flesh-eating diseases. So do that. Just go walk slowly through a forest. Get a decent forest. Maybe take your 20-minute walk there. And you will have an anti-cancer effect in the body that will last for 1 month or 30 days. That research has been done in Japan specifically for that one thing, and those papers are there. So it is very beneficial to you to do this. Then I will talk about one other tree. My God, I've been looking for it for 20 years, and I found the rarest tree in the whole of the United States, down in Texas. And I went down there, and a friend of mine is fairly wealthy. I had a helicopter, and I scanned with a pair of binoculars hanging from a leather vest out of the chopper. I scanned a 200-mile area, because I knew the tree had to be there. I was sure the tree, it's the sacred tree of the First Nations, and I found it. I have found the rarest tree in the Americas, and that tree has got the ability to synergize all medicines. And it has an extraordinary ability. It is an old, old, ancient tree of all of the First Nations, going down to the Seminole people. And that one was put into their medicine bags, and it made every other medicine that they used more active. And now it's under guard, and I'm trying to propagate that here, and I'm trying to propagate it down in Texas. And it will be under public patent for everybody.
And is that that's not the same thing as you wrote about? Is this the Rutaceae family tree, this lemon grapefruit tree?
Yes, that's right.
That's that one.
Yes, Rutaceae family.
Rutaceae, okay.
Yes, Rutaceae family. And that family has probably got some real prizes in it for medicine. Oh, my goodness, that family has got some marvelous, marvelous medicines in it. But there is one tree that I found, and I found it in its fruiting state. And that I've generated money for some organic chemical people to look at it, and I got a philanthropist to put in $5 million to get the graduate students looking at it, and that research is on its way, and that one will have a public patent. What I'm saying, it is anti-cancer, and that public patent will be out there like aspirin will be out there, like you will not pay vast quantities of money for that. That's in the future.
Two things made me think of, as you were saying that. Let me do the patent part first, and then ask a question about the tree specifically. What you're saying in terms of what you're releasing to the world here with this is not something so you can make a huge profit. You're saying
make money on that.
So the public really can use this and use it for their own healing.
Yes, absolutely. Yes, then yes, and yes again to that. Yes, I think that the heritage of those species belongs to us all. They don't belong to one multinational. I think they are the property of everybody. I do not like to see people suffering and in pain. I will not have that. And if I can do anything to stop it, I'm doing it. So that's why I'm looking for antibiotics. That's why I'm looking for antifungicides. That's why I'm looking for anti-cancer compounds in all of the species of North America, because they're absolutely extraordinary.
Because you do believe that and both as a scientist and as a very spiritual woman as well, from the old way, that you believe that a lot of the healing elements for human beings are within these trees.
Yes. 60% of all of the medicines over the counter in the drugstores that you go to right now, all of you, come from trees.
So this particular tree you were talking about a moment ago, the Rutacea, did I say that correctly?
Yeah,
Rutacea. Rutacea tree. So where did why did they disappear? You said they were like ubiquitous across the native lands where we live. What happened to them?
Well, I can tell you what happened with them. They're a small tree. It's a small tree. It's a tree like a grapefruit or an orange tree, just a small little tree. And what happened with the clearing of the land, now especially in Canada, when people were given land grants, they were made to cut down the forests. And to own land here, it was taken away from the Aboriginal people. To own the land here, you had to clear the forests. And I do know, because I talked to the medicine men and medicine women, I talked to them about that, and they tried to tell the white people that they were destroying their own medicine. But you see, the people who'd come in here from Europe had never seen any trees like that before and did not understand that medicine came from shrubs. And it's the same thing with the frost banana, the Annonaceae family in the United States. That family is a really unique family to the United States. I think there's one other species outside of the United States. When the settlers and the pioneers came into the Americas, they were told that by the Aboriginal people, but they didn't think that these trees were significant. And they were, when they came in, you know, remember, Mark, when they came in, they'd come from Europe. Europe was in hell because there was war everywhere all over Europe. Mm-hmm. So they were really starving people, essentially, or running away from religion or something like that, that they came to America. They were only looking for firewood, and they were looking for food. And the food that they knew was rye or barley or, you know, cows or pigs and chickens and hens. That's all they knew. They did not know the treasure trove that was here on this continent. And we only have that treasure trove left because the Aboriginal people kept it that way.
So that piece of your story, those pieces of your stories for me in your books, just ring so clear with so much clarity just about what we were potentially losing on this planet, what we've lost over the last several hundred years, and what we have to kind of reclaim.
You
can read your book in there, like each little piece is a meditative piece, but it's more than a meditative piece because of all the knowledge inside.
Well, you know, the global forest, I wanted that as the prayer book of the forest. The penguin, in their great wisdom, I am being sarcastic here now, they did not like the idea of prayer going into a book. Do you know what I mean?
Uh-huh.
Because they might think, God knows what they were thinking. And I thought, well, we do need meditation. We do need little pieces of silence in all of our lives. So, of course, that's the title came out as The Global Forest. But in my mind, it is a meditation, piece of meditation, which is very necessary for all of us to think about where we're living, where we're situated, and who lives around us by way of trees or people. It doesn't matter.
Well, it came through because my wife and I look at this Global Forest book as a piece of meditation. As,
you know,
as
I'm getting to like your wife more and more.
She's a very special person.
Of course, you're biased here.
I am.
I'm going to send you some cotton wool to wrap her in because she sounds very precious.
She is that. One of the things that really struck me that this one chapter in the other book, the Sweetness of a Simple Life, that your cheap chick chapter about the hummingbirds. But you mentioned this, and I'll say if I say this incorrectly, you'll correct me. Peonia lactiflora.
Yeah, Peonia lactiflora.
Yes,
yeah.
You like those.
Oh gosh, yes, and I've been breeding them. Oh, you got that message. You know, you see, what happened is the Peonia lactiflora from China. We had lost the black variety, Peonia lactiflora chocolate soldier, and that flower smells of chocolate. It's huge, huge, big black blossoms. And, of course, I have been looking for that. You know, I have got a bucket list. I have a wish list for all kinds of species. And that one I tried to find. I finally found it in Cambridge University. There was one plant left. And I got the gang there to in England to clone it. and they cloned it in 11 test tubes. And they sent the test tube rack and the test tubes and bunged all the test tubes, wrapped it all together with plastic, sent it through the post. And, of course, my postmaster called me here in the house and said, Diana, you've got something very strange that's come through the post and I'm not touching it. So he's a big, tall Scot with big red hair. So anyway, I went in and he was there standing on the other side of the counter and his big, long hands and he pointed his index finger and pushed it towards me and he said, there, that's for you. So when I had it in my little grubby hands, I said to him, oh, I said, thank you so much, James. It's wonderful. And then he got curious and he said, well, what is it? I said, aha, next year or the year after, I said, I will invite you to my garden and you will see what this is. And of course, I buried it. I buried it and kept it way under the frost level. Popped it up in March, then started growing this clonal material, and I have the black peonies. But since then, I have been crossing them, and I've got silver peonies from them.
Mm.
I know. So
do they still smell like chocolate?
Yes, they smell like chocolate. So now, here's me being very eccentric here. Every morning that they're out in June, I make a cup of tea. Now, this is a secret between you and me. I make a cup of tea. I take my tea out into the garden because I've got a big border of them, all different types of them, and I go to each one and smell them. Oh, my goodness. Oh, you know, that's why you're alive. It's wonderful, wonderful, wonderful.
Which is why you live where you live.
Yes, yes, yes. Yes, you know. So that's my little secret.
So tell me a bit about this, because you alluded to this earlier, about this film that's coming out. What is this film that's coming out that you...
The film is really about the forests, how we can regain the forests. I'm talking, I've just finished doing the voiceover for it, and it will be released on the 31st of August. It's going all over the world. It is a theatrical documentary, just like any ordinary straight film for all the theatres. And it's telling you the glory of all the trees, of the redwoods, what you do, like, say, for instance, going into the redwoods, how you breathe them, and how you take forest bathing exercises with the redwoods, and all the species. I'm taking you through that, and then into Japan, into Germany, and into the old Celtic world of Ireland, the first language of Europe. Outside of Sanskrit, now that is Indian Sanskrit, the first language of Europe was based on trees. Andar in Old Gaelic is the name for an oak, and Andar is the Sanskrit for it. So it's very, very ancient. So I'm bringing you on the travel of all these wonderful, wonderful things.
So that's, again, going back, marrying the science and the sacred, because you're finding the connections between our ancientness as a species and the trees we lived with, you know, and actually lived with as fellow beings on this planet.
That's right, yes. That's
even if
right.
We used them or cut them or burned them or whatever, but we knew what we were doing. We knew who they were.
Yes, yes. And now we're at the sweet point. Now we know the great value of them. And in the film, I interview, I have very good friends all over the place.
I'm sure you do.
In the academic community. And my good friend Bill Libby, who is really the geneticist, he's the top geneticist in the world for the redwoods, and he's a total darling. And he and I have this walk in the redwoods, and of course I'm talking about the chemistry, and I'm talking how it'll benefit you if you have had any cancers, or if you do have cancer in your family, what to do there. And that was a wonderful, wonderful walk. He's a marvelous man. And then I talk to the Japanese scientists and in Japan, and I was invited by the politicians of Japan to help with the planting of the Green Wall of Japan for the protection of the people in Fukushima. And I was down on my hands and knees planting laurels. And I'll tell you something, Mark, I am so honored to have done that. I felt when I stood up from planting those trees with those hundreds and hundreds of Japanese people to protect their own land, I got my Nobel Prize.
Mm. Mm.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Right. You couldn't, even if you hit me on the head with the Nobel Prize now, I would say, nope, I'm sorry, I reached a higher plane doing that. You know, because an old woman came up to me, and God help us, she had, you know, only a few teeth left, and she held my hands and she started crying. Mm. I was the only Caucasian there, and they were all, oh, it was wonderful, with Akira Miyawaki. It was the most wonderful thing I have ever done in my life. It was, I felt we were all working together. And that old woman just put her arms around me, and they don't do that in Japan, I'll tell you. Like, they don't do things like that. Mm-hmm. But it was just a marvelous moment. It was marvelous. So I have my trees planted in Japan, and I am cruising along doing the same thing in other places.
It made me think of that. There's so much in your books, where you, because you spent most of your life now in Ottawa, mm-hmm. In mm-hmm. Canada, on the land.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
You write a lot about the at different points in the book about the native peoples of Canada and other places, yes. that you've walked through the woods with and learned. This woman, yeah. Cece, and others that you learn from as you mm-hmm. walk through the forest. And I'm curious how that, what that's done for you. What's that done for your knowledge base? What that's done for your spiritual base to be able to so close to the land, but the people who actually lived in that land who know it.
There's a smoothness of silk in the medicine men and medicine women. They speak very slowly. They think very hard.
Mm-hmm.
Their thinking is lateral. To be in their presence is like to be in the presence of some very fine silks. And sitting in the softness of their meditation is wonderful. They're extraordinary people. They have this extraordinary generosity towards all others in the sense of, I love you as you love me. It is a form of, it's like going into a warm pool of water and just bathing.
Mm.
It feels lovely for me being in their company. And when I address universities, and I will be doing that in a week or so's time, again, I always address members of First Nations first, then the president of the university, then the academic team I'm in dealing with, then the students and fellow colleagues. I always put them top of the list. So that's where they should be. And that's where I think of them as being.
That's why I asked you. I thought that was the case, and I just wanted to hear you describe
and
that.
And I was doing a health conference here in North America, and I did address the First Nations first, and the chieftains there started crying. They said, we have never been acknowledged before. And I said, you are being acknowledged by me.
Well, you bring so much to us in this world. To me, I'm so glad that my lovely Valerie put your books in the bathroom.
Oh no, she's looking after you, and you don't even know.
That's it. All I can say is, Diana Beresford Kroger, this has been just a delight for me to have at least this beginning opportunity to speak with you about these wonderful books in your life, and I appreciate it so much.
Mark, I'm very honored, and I am honored that your wife is pushing you into the bathroom.
She may lock me in there, you never know.
Oh. It's my pleasure.
Thank you. You're listening to Your Source for Cool Jazz and More, WEAA 88.9 FM, The Voice of the Community. And that's the great song Up on Cripple Creek by the band. Richard Manuel of the band was born on this day in 1943.
Up on Cripple Creek, she sends me in my spring a leap. She mends me, I don't have to speak, but she defends me, a drunkard's dream.